essential role in all struggles, whether they are Chileans, Cubans, or Palestinians. It's the women who provide an education to the young Palestinians. It's the women who provide assistance in the refugee camps. It's them, again, who pass down our culture through the generations.
The role of the women fighting for freedom was discussed during a round table, the liberation of the territories from the Israeli occupation, and the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination were also among the topics touched on during the meeting.
Over the past days, Israel has resumed bombarding the northern parts of the Gaza Strip. This after hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in previous Israeli bombardments of the Gaza Strip carried out between May 10 and May 20. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory.
What is going in Palestine is clearly against the international law, against the UN resolutions. And what is happening by keeping some countries their silence is giving impunity to the occupier.
Unfortunately, nothing will change if the UN and all major countries continue not to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
People at Rome's Palestinian Day event have called on Palestinians to remain steadfast and fight for their rights despite their suffering. Max Civili, Rome.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The rapid rise of the highly transmissible strain in the UK has put countries in Europe and North America on watch. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Ewan Calloway, researcher. This article is published under the heading Delta Coronavirus Variant. Scientists brace for impact. Stay tuned for more. When the first cases of the SARS-CoV-2 Delta variant were detected in the UK in mid-April, the nation was getting ready to open up. COVID-19 case numbers, hospitalizations, and deaths were plummeting thanks to the months of lockdown and the vaccination programs. 2 months later, the variant, which was first detected in India, has catalyzed the third UK wave and forced the government to delay the full reopening of society it had originally slated for June 21st. After observing the startlingly swift rise of the Delta variant in the UK, other countries are bracing for the variant's impact if they aren't feeling it already. countries without large vaccine stocks, some scientists worry that the variant could be devastating. In my mind, it will be really hard to keep out this variant, says Tom Wenzeler, an evolutionary biologist and biostatistician at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium, adding, it's very likely it will take over altogether on a worldwide basis. Delta, also known as B1617.2, belongs to a viral lineage first identified in India during a ferocious wave of infections in April and May. The lineage grew rapidly in some parts of the country and showed signs of partial resistance to vaccines. But it was difficult for researchers to disentangle these intrinsic properties of the variant from other factors driving India's confirmed cases past 400,000 per day, such as mass gatherings. Delta variant has been linked to a resurgence of COVID-19 in Nepal, Southeast Asia, and elsewhere, but its UK spread has given scientists a clear picture of the threat it poses. Delta seems to be around 60% more transmissible than the already highly infectious Alpha variant, also called B117, identified in the UK in late 2020. Preliminary evidence from England and Scotland suggests that people infected with Delta are about twice as likely to end up in hospital compared with those infected with Alpha. The data coming out of the UK is so good that we have a really good idea about how Delta variant is behaving, says Mats Albertsen, a bioinformation at Aalborg University in Denmark. That's been an eye-opener, he added. Denmark, which, like the UK, is a world leader in genomic surveillance, has also seen a steady rise in cases caused by Delta variant, although far fewer than most other European countries. It is only a matter of time before the variant becomes dominant in Denmark, says Albertsen. But the hope is that its expansion can be slowed through vaccination, surveillance, and enhanced contact tracing. He says it's going to take over. Meanwhile, the Danish government is easing restrictions, not reimposing them. Restaurants have been opening for months to individuals who have been vaccinated or received a recent negative test. And as of June 14th, masks are no longer required in most indoor settings. Cases of the Delta variant in the UK are doubling roughly every 11 days. Delta is also on the rise in the U.S., particularly in Midwest and Southeast. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention declared it a variant of concern on June 15th. But patchy surveillance means the picture there is less clear, according to nationwide sampling conducted by the genomics company Helix in San Mateo, California. Delta is rising fast in the U.S. Using a rapid genotyping test, the company has found that the proportion of cases caused by Alpha fell from more than 70% in late April to around 42% as of mid-June, with the rise of Delta driving much of the shift. Jeremy Camille, a virologist at Louisiana State University Health in Shreveport, expects Delta to eventually become dominant in the U.S., but to be somewhat blunted by vaccination. However, vast disparities in vaccination rates could lead to regional and local variation in cases and hospitalization caused by Delta, says Jennifer Surtees, a biochemist at the University of Buffalo, New York, who is conducting regional surveillance. She notes that 70% of eligible New Yorkers have received at least one dose of vaccine, a milestone that triggered the lifting of most COVID-19 restrictions recently, but that figure is below 40% in some parts of the state. Communities with high proportions of African American and Hispanic individuals, where vaccination rates tend to be very low, could be especially hard hit by Delta. These are populations that are really at risk of a localized outbreak from Delta. So I think it's really important to still keep tracking and watch this as much as possible, Surtees says. Data from Helix on nearly 20,000 samples sequenced since April suggest that the Delta variant is spreading faster in U.S. counties, where less than 30% of residents have been fully vaccinated, compared to the counties with vaccination rates above that threshold. Delta poses the biggest risk, scientists say, to countries that have limited access to vaccines, particularly those in Africa, where most nations have vaccinated less than 5% of their populations. The vaccines will never come in time, says Wenselaers. If these kinds of new variants arrive, it can be very devastating. Surveillance in African countries is extremely limited, but there are hints that the variant is already causing cases there to surge. Several sequences of the variant have been reported in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where an outbreak in the capital city of Kinshasa has filled hospitals. The variant has also been detected in Malawi, Uganda, and South Africa. Countries that have close economic links to India, such as those in East Africa, are probably at the greatest risk of seeing a surge in cases caused by Delta, says Tulio do Oliveira, a bioinformation and director of the KwaZulu-Natal Research and Innovation Sequencing Platform in Durban, South Africa. In his country, all of the Delta cases have been detected in shipping crews at commercial ports, with no signs yet of a spread in the general community. South Africa is in the middle of a third wave of infections caused by the Beta variant, also known as B1351, identified there last year. This, combined with a lack of travel from countries affected by Delta, should make it harder for a new variant to take hold. Similar factors could be keeping Delta at bay in Brazil, which is battling another immune-evading variant called P1 or Gamma, says Gonzalo Bello, a virologist at Oswaldo Cruz Institute in Rio de Janeiro, who is a part of a team conducting national surveillance. So far, Brazil has sequenced just 4 cases of the Delta variant in the country. While countries gird themselves against the Delta variant or hope that it passes them by, researchers say they need to watch for even greater threats. What most people are concerned about are the next variants. If we start to see variants that can really challenge the vaccines, says Albert Sen.
Department of War Studies at King's College London, an academic institution with strong links to the British security state, where a large number of British, American, and European agents and defense analysts receive training. However, in a new investigation, Mint Press News has explored how the department acts as a school for spies. The faculty is filled with current or former NATO officials, army and intelligence officers, to train the next generation of spies and intelligence officers. A 2009 study published by the CIA says how beneficial it could be to use universities as a means of intelligence training, noting that exposure to an academic environment such as the Department of War Studies at King's College London can add several elements that may be harder to provide within the government system. The paper, written by two King's College staffers, is essentially a request to the Central Intelligence Agency to send more of its recruits there. In 2013, former CIA director Leon Panetta took time out of his schedule as the U.S. Secretary of Defense to pay a visit to the Department of War Studies and expressed his deep gratitude to it.
It was 70 years ago.
One of King's College's most famous professors is Mats Berdal. Before joining the college in 2018, he was director of studies at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS, a leading think tank in the world. The institute is directly funded by NATO and its member states, as well as by major weapons manufacturers such as Airbus, BAE Systems, Boeing, and Raytheon. In 2016, the IISS was the subject of a major scandal after it was found to have secretly accepted £25 million from Bahrain. Today, IISS is a major player in the growing hostility towards China, Russia, and North Korea. A number of other current Department of War Studies academics have held positions at the IISS as well. Indeed, King's College boasts that among the key benefits of studying there is its established links with the IISS. Another famous member of King's College's Department of War Studies is Professor Sir Lawrence Freedman. A powerful figure in British politics, Freedman contributed to the then British Prime Minister Tony Blair's speech in the year 1999, in which he established the Blair Doctrine, according to which NATO could and should militarily intervene anywhere in the world to stop what they considered to be human rights violations. Whereas the institution takes great pride in promoting independent thought, there exists a significant overlap between the staff of the Department of War Studies and the halls of power of the British state. And the distributing point is that many of these faculty members are basically warmongers. Sir Malcolm Rifkind, visiting professor at King's College, for example, rejected the idea that the United Kingdom should use atomic missiles only as a last resort after being attacked. Instead, he believes and insists that the country could also use them simply to deliver an unmistakable message of Britain's willingness to defend her vital interests. It is not just British officials who teach King's College students, however. Christopher Kalinda, for example, has the experience of commanding a US task force in Afghanistan under his belt. The department also has a number of Israeli academics, including Ofer Friedman, who served as an officer in the IDF between 1999 and 2011, during which time it was carrying out some of its worst war crimes against Palestine and Lebanon. After leaving the IDF, Friedman became an arms dealer. In 2016, King's College also hosted a lecture by a former head of Shin Bet, the Israeli secret police force. Whereas the War Department's teaching staff are a cause of concern, much of King's College academic output is even more disturbing and seems to be totally in line with that of NATO and weapons contractors. For instance, one study titled A Benefit, Not a Burden, the security, economic, and strategic value of Britain's defense industry looks more like a press release from an arms manufacturer in which it praises the benefits of the arms industry, such as job creations for many people. While King's College gives an academic appearance to the national security state, Bellingcat, an investigative site in close cooperation with the college, provides a journalistic one. This bunch of think tanks, academic reports, and so-called investigative articles all cite one another as credible, independent sources when in reality they are all part of the same network promoting an agenda. Another troubling product of the War Department is the journalists it trains. A great number of the world's most prominent reporters, producers, and presenters, representing many of the most well-known media outlets, including the New York Times, CNN, and the BBC, are graduates of this London department. This fact, per se, raises serious questions about the links between the press and the national security state. Meanwhile, this British university has managed to attract many students from the other side of the Atlantic. Currently, there are 1,265 Americans enrolled, making up about 4% of the student body. After graduation, many of these students would attain powerful positions in major American media outlets. Andrew Carey, CNN's bureau chief in Jerusalem, for example, completed a master's there in 2012. His coverage of the latest Israeli attack on Gaza presented the apartheid state as responding to Hamas rocket attacks, rather than being the instigator of violence. Needless to say, the BBC, the British state broadcaster, is packed with the War Department's graduates. In the words of Matt Kennard, an investigative journalist for Declassified UK, it's an open secret that King's College London Department of War Studies operates as the finishing school for Anglo-American securocrats. So it's maybe not a surprise that graduates of its various military and intelligence courses also enter into a world of corporate journalism that exists to launder the messaging of these same security agencies. Such things highlight the disturbingly close links between the national security state and the press, which the public usually rely on to be a check on their power and to hold them accountable. Those journalists trained in such an environment are very susceptible to seeing things the way their professors do, and perhaps they would be less likely to challenge their state power when the officials they are scrutinizing were their classmates or teachers. According to Oliver Boyd Barrett, Professor Emeritus at Bowling Green State School of Media and Communication, while it strikes me as very interesting that a single academic institution could play such a major role in the recruitment of pro-establishment activist intellectuals and delivery of the same to the media, it is not so surprising. Sad to say, rather than challenging power and the powers that be, many of the mainstream media just echo and amplify their messages, almost uncritically. The level of faith modern journalists have in the powerful was summed up in a recent tweet by former CNN White House correspondent Michelle Kaczynski. As an American journalist, you never expect, one, your own government to lie to you repeatedly, two, your own government to hide information the public has a right to know, and three, your own government to spy on your communications. It is not a good sign for a democracy and freedom of information when so many spooks, government officials, as well as journalists who are supposed to hold them accountable, are all friends and classmates. The worrying fact is that the Department of War Studies is just one part of this broad phenomenon.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to the American academic and political commentator Marjorie Cohn, racist violence against black people and other minorities has been part of the very fabric of the United States. Marjorie Cohn also said that the recent violent incidents involving white police officers are part of systemic racist police violence against black people in America. We're prepared for an article written by Kelly Carter Jackson. The NAFOR Assistant Professor of Humanities in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. The piece is titled, "The Derek Chauvin Verdict Won't Stop Cops Murdering Black People." Since May of last year, the world has been waiting for justice for George Floyd, who was killed on the streets of Minneapolis after allegedly trying to use a counterfeit $20 bill at a convenience store. The jury found police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all counts: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. It was an emotional verdict in what has been an emotional year since his killing. How are Americans to receive this moment? This verdict has been long time coming, and it's been a painful, difficult wait. Many times I have had to remind people that it was Derek Chauvin who was on trial and not George Floyd. Over and over, people questioned George Floyd's history, his drug use and his actions, anything that would shift the blame for his own death away from Derek Chauvin. As W.E.B. Du Bois, an American historian, civil rights activist, pan-Africanist, author, writer, and editor, once wrote, "Nothing in the world is easier in the United States than to accuse a black man of a crime." That is still true today. Despite all we have gone through, despite all the protests, activism, and calls for justice, we'll still see black people as criminals. Perhaps the most arduous task of the prosecution was not to prove that Derek Chauvin played a role in George Floyd's death, but to prove that George Floyd was in fact a human being. A deep-seated and pervasive culture of racism is to blame for the fact that his humanity was ever in question. As historians, the greatest opposition we can show white supremacy is to tell the truth. I have grown tired of politicians and pundits claiming that Derek Chauvin was a bad apple or an anomaly. No, the truth is, he is a mirror of white supremacy. The violence he committed was white supremacy in its purest form. For some, to mention this obvious fact is to be divisive. On Fox News Channel, Tucker Carlson issued a hateful diatribe about the trial, in which he said, No one on CNN actually cares about George Floyd now. What they care about is you and your role in the systemic racism that supposedly killed George Floyd. Tucker Carlson said the purpose of speaking about racism is to punish you and to change America. He said that is why they are replaying that video of George Floyd dying on the sidewalk, to remind you of all that, of your culpability in his death. Tucker Carlson goes on to say that if the George Floyd Derek Chauvin trial ends up in acquittal, there could be riots. We accept that as a fact of life in this country. No civilized country should accept that, but suddenly we do. Apparently, Carlson thinks a civilized country should accept black Americans being killed in broad daylight by police officers. Much as Tucker Carlson and his ilk would like us to keep silent about white supremacy, we cannot and we will not. Since this trial began, 3 people a day have been killed by the police. Over half of these victims are black and Latino people. We will repeat it over and over and over again until black people stop being murdered in the streets by police officers. This is the audacity of white supremacy, that a white police officer could, in broad daylight, while being recorded among a gathering of witnesses, kneel on a black man's neck until he dies. He kneeled despite the fact that George Floyd told him he couldn't breathe, and he kept kneeling despite the fact that Floyd told him he was going to die. In this country, a black athlete like Colin Kaepernick can't peacefully kneel on the ground in protest without backlash. Yet, a white police officer can kneel on a black man's neck until he dies. The verdict doesn't take away from that fact. It's hard to know if Derek Chauvin ever recognized George Floyd's humanity. That's what made the weeks of questions and cross-examination of witnesses that took place so gruelingly to watch. I watched Derek Chauvin's body language throughout the trial. He always appeared indifferent. What notes was he taking? What, if any, testimony moved him to feel empathy? In the 9 minutes, 29 seconds that Derek Chauvin's knee was on George Floyd's neck, all I saw was defiance on his part. He was a belligerent cop who was not going to be told how to do his job. Derek Chauvin never exhibited remorse. But even if he did, remorse does nothing to further justice. Rendering George Floyd's death as a series of unfortunate events does nothing to alter violent outcomes for black people. Make no mistake, a conviction for Derek Chauvin is not equivalent to a vaccine that will protect us from death and injury. A prison sentence will not protect black people from the violence of the police. Black men, women, and children are still being killed by the police. There are no winners in this outcome. An acquittal is not justice. A conviction is not justice. In America, we have never seen justice because justice is a system that fully recognizes black humanity. And we are far from a justice system like that. The stakes of white supremacy do not start or even end with this verdict. George Floyd's family will never recover his life, his love, or laughter. Black Americans will not cease to be seen as threats, and Derek Chauvin will walk away as the exception rather than the rule. Racist violence against black people and other minorities has been part of the very fabric of the United States. Recent violent incidents involving white police officers are part of a systemic racist police violence against black people in America. Marjorie Cohn, who is a professor emeritus at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, California, and also a former president of the National Lawyers Guild, made the remarks in an online interview recently. From the day witnesses began to testify in the Derek Chauvin trial on 29th of March through to 18th of April, at least 64 people in the United States died at the hands of law enforcement. More than half of those victims were black and brown. During the trial, 20-year-old Duante White was shot and killed by a police officer very close to the courthouse where Derek Chauvin was being tried. The police officer claimed she was reaching for her taser, but grabbed her gun instead. Even if she had used the taser, that would have constituted a use of excessive force. These are not isolated occurrences, but rather part of systemic racist police violence against black people in the United States. The new U.S. President Joe Biden is claiming that he supports police reform and supposedly is a vast improvement over his predecessor, Donald Trump. But he cautioned, don't expect him to propose real systemic change, including defunding and abolition of the police. The United States was established in the wake of a long history of slavery and committed genocide on the indigenous population of the United States. From the slave codes to the black codes, racist violence has been part of the very fabric of this country. Jim Crow laws, which followed Reconstruction, kept African Americans oppressed. That legacy is embodied in today's policing, which is steeped in systemic and racist violence.
Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Pattingill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace.
That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu.
Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
Not for me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
Well, if you'll pardon my stealing a film line, the force is with us.
You have stated flatly that you did not trade weapons for hostages.
What began as a strategic opening to Iran
deteriorated in its implementation.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. God bless you.
Cut.
Take that, Mr. Gorbachev.
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the U.S. And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film, because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer, you see Reagan saying, "Make America Great Again," which obviously we have more modern connotations to today. But it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance-driven thing to a more sort of style and, you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
But perhaps the onus of the documentary and perspective is on the rests in the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without generation.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much, you know, it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world, but reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even more pernicious, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed. And we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image of a president.
So Neil, if I could bring you in here, that was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said, and I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made, but the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically, it was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round the log fire, all American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalized with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts, and this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show.
We were riding to the airport yesterday afternoon, and my mother was talking about in Arkansas that they were trying to pass a law to give 150 or pay people standing in their homes instead of going to the old folks' home. I made the comment, I said, I didn't think it should give anything. I thought we should take care of our own, you know, that's my feelings. My little one, I thought, was asleep in the back seat, and he raised up, and he said, "Granny, that's why Ronald Reagan's the president. Stop all these giveaway programs."
Tell me, you had the experience, Mr. President, at one time of auditioning for film roles, and then when you ran for governor and president, you were auditioning in front of the public for office. Which is more difficult?
Well, what I have to say, this one is, yeah.
you have to, well, you not only have to get the part, you have to write the script.
And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and we see the mask slip a bit when we see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. Mm. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for a president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly bright. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to have had a reputation of being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker, and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense, the documentary is capturing this, isn't it? That he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image, and the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So, yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. Mm-hmm. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theater that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, you know, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage, you know, and you saw him in the clip before. He ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor. Mm-hmm. And that's fascinating to me because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president. But actually, a sort of very average to mediocre actor can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting. And we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War.
There.
By making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency, you'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office. So Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. And as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
So Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like, and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states, where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements, and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks, the defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well with the Nicaraguan Revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents two things. He represents a kind of counterattack by the corporations and the rich inside America against workers, against the poor, and against the social movements. And internationally, an attempt to reassert US imperial control over what is effectively an informal empire. They want to shore up US power at a time when the US economy is weakening, and that weakening of economic clout, which had been crucial to US power in the 50s and the 60s, to some degree you can compensate for that by substituting a more aggressive military stance. And I think that's what's happening under Reagan.
And in this documentary, land that he was called a trigger-happy president, although he said he strived for peace, we saw sort of contradictions there.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right, because there's this massive, massive increase in arms expenditure, which brings it right up to the level that it was at the beginning of the Cold War in the early 1950s. And it creates a huge economic problem for the United States, a massive, massive budget deficit. I mean, all this stuff, you know, all this neoliberal stuff they're saying about how we need to control our budgets and we don't want big government, it's all nonsense. If you look at the military expenditure and the way it's being funded by borrowing, it has a crippling effect on the US economy in the long run. But what it does do is it breaks the back, this is the crucial thing, I think, of the Soviet Union. Because the Soviet Union, a much smaller economy and a failing economy, simply can't match these levels of arms expenditure. So you've got a second Cold War, which in a sense, Reagan wins by just upping the stakes to a level which the Soviets can't match.
That's really interesting. I want to pick up that point in the next part of the discussion, actually. And Lee, if I could ask you, did you see any similarities between Reagan and Trump? Because many critics have drawn many similarities between them and parallels.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Trump would love to be, you know, as idolized as Reagan. And, you know, the whole Make America Great Again, which you hear Reagan say very early on in this documentary, you know, there's no, that's not a coincidence. He's trying to echo the sort of style. The difference is, and again, regardless if you agree with the policies, Reagan has a charm and a sort of, you know, acceptability to a large number of people. Trump obviously has a base. I mean, he won the election, even if he lost the popular vote. But it's kind of, you know, right-wing Republicanism with the mask off. It's the sort of the aggression and the kind of tit-for-tat stuff and the sort of intolerance which was, you know, largely covered by Reagan's, you know, kind of charm and sort of, you know, persona. That's all gone. And what's interesting now is it's like you don't even need that cover, it seems, at the moment to kind of succeed. And that's quite a sort of fairly terrifying development, I would say.
Indeed, and critics say that actually Reagan set the precedent for today's facts don't matter politics. And critics also say that Trump sort of coined this fake news sort of propaganda and techniques from the Reagan era. And we heard in the documentary, actually, that Reagan was aware of the frenzy he would cause with the media just to be able to dodge questions, so to speak. So do you think that there are similarities between the two?
Yeah, but we must be careful. I mean, fake news is a current term, but politicians have always lied, especially when they're defending a vested interest. They've always lied to the people, so we need to be quite careful. That's the old word, really, for fake news in a sense. But I think it is true. There's been a ramping up of that. And Reagan starts it, and it's now at an absolutely epidemic level, I think, with Trump and actually with the Tory government in Britain as well. We've actually got to a point where lying has become, fake news if you like, lying seems to have become pretty much systematic and institutionalized. So politicians are completely routinely saying the opposite to the public of what is actually happening behind the scenes. And it's there with Reagan, because everything Reagan is saying about, you know, this is a struggle between right and wrong, this is a crusade for freedom, Russia is the evil empire, all of this kind of stuff, this Cold War rhetoric that's being pumped out, is hiding, I mean, terrible atrocities and injustices which are being perpetrated by American imperialism.
I'll have to pause you there. We will pick up that more in the next part.
Gorbachev seems to be most confident that he can outperform Ronald Reagan. He's feeling comfortable, he's feeling good about the way things are going, and he thinks that he should be able to strut his stuff as well on the world stage.
It is Gorbachev who is very vocal with the press, talking, right, laughing, smiling. It is Mr. Reagan who is sitting back, speaking monosyllabically. Now, why isn't Mr. Reagan coming forward in the way that we've seen him in the past?
Gorbachev is trying to win through public opinion what he doesn't necessarily get at the negotiating table. If he can gain leverage against the United States through his propaganda efforts, then he can win something at the table.
And so the stage is set for Mr. Reagan and Gorbachev to report on their summit. With every indication, they will call it a success. But behind all the smiles and rhetoric, the question is whether they have really done something to make the world breathe easier.
So we see a lot of Gorbachev featuring in this documentary, and I think he's portrayed in a more charismatic light, and he seems to come across as a more bold leader than Reagan from the media clips that we've seen in this film. Lee, can I ask you, what did you make of their rivalry and how the, Gorbachev was portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the film is The Reagan Show, and it obviously concentrates on Reagan, but Gorbachev becomes a major player within the film because it kind of builds, you know, the Cold War as the overarching narrative for it. He comes across as incredibly charismatic and very intelligent, and I think what you see is there's a section where they show that actually the Russians or the Soviet Union hire an American PR firm to help with their own promotion and, you know, marketing effectively. So it's very clear that, I think the other thing we have to be really careful is, this is not just an American or a Western thing, this performance thing. Every country indulges in this. Every nation, you know, distorts the views that they need to sort of, you know, win the public opinion and stuff. It's not just the States, it's not just the West. And you see how the Soviet Union becomes very adept very quickly, and it's also got a very media savvy figurehead who can basically go toe-to-toe with Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I think as much as Reagan obviously, you know, had a big part in play in the Cold War, I think you underestimate Gorbachev's role also doing that, whether it's only because, you know, the Soviet Union couldn't afford an arms race, but I think, you know, you could also look at it in a positive way and say, yes, there's also an impetus to try and break this kind of escalation that's going on.
That is a good point, actually. It does make you think, this documentary, about how intertwined the media and politics are. And Neil, I just wanted to quickly touch on how Star Wars was introduced in this documentary, and it was seen as actually not existing, and it was a PR stunt to bring the Russians to the negotiating table. How accurate is this?
I think the Star Wars initiative was very, very real. I mean, I think this is why it's true to call it the Second Cold War, because if the US had developed the technology to shoot missiles down from space, the effect would have been that the mutually assured destruction, which had basically acted as a mutual deterrent, would suddenly have gone. The Russians were genuinely very, very frightened by this development and couldn't match it. They didn't have the technology and they didn't have the economic resources. And I think that that is a stick with which to beat Gorbachev. You see, I think Gorbachev was actually a more serious political player than Reagan. I think he really was driving it. I mean, what you see actually on the screen with Gorbachev is real. He's the young reformer who really is trying to transform the Soviet Union. And behind the scenes, what's actually happening is Reagan and his advisors are not giving much ground at all, particularly on Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And it's actually the Russians who make all of the concessions because they're so desperate.
Yes, we do see it, especially from this documentary, that the Americans are on the back foot. And so the final 20 seconds to you, Lee, as we're running out of time, would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I mean, it's a fascinating look at, you know, an era that really where video and, you know, the performance aspect came to power. You could argue that, you know, this is not, it didn't start with Reagan. You think of Kennedy and Nixon and the TV debates that people thought TV Kennedy won and radio thought Nixon won. But, it, you know, it shows that it got ramped up at this moment, and it had a Hollywood actor. So it's kind of a perfect, you know, Hollywood.